Chapter 40. During the next few days, Sean and Saul reported to the headquarters of the regional commander and were assigned neither billets nor duties. Now that they had arrived, no one seemed very interested in them. They were told to report daily and turned loose again. They returned to Candy's hotel and spent most of the days playing billiards or cards, and most of the evenings eating and drinking and talking. A week of this and Sean was getting bored. He began to feel like a stud stallion. Even a solid diet of heavenly manna begins to pall after a while, so when Candy asked him to escort her to a reception and dinner with which Lord Kitchener was celebrating his promotion to Supreme Command of the Army in South Africa, Sean accepted with relief. "You look like some sort of god," Candy told him, as he entered her suite through the concealed doorway, which connected it with his own bedroom in the Victoria Rooms. When she had shown him this discreet little panel and demonstrated how at a touch it slid silently aside, Sean had thrust down the temptation of asking how many others had used it. It was senseless to resent the nameless host who had passed through the panel to teach Candy all those little tricks with which she now delighted him. "You don't look so bad yourself." She was dressed in blue silk, the colour of her eyes, and she wore diamonds at her throat. "How gallant you are." She came to him and stroked the silk lapels of his newly tailored evening jacket. "I wish you'd wear your medals." "I haven't any medals." "Oh, Sean, you must have. With all those bullet holes in you, you must have medals." "I'm sorry, Candy," Sean grinned. At times, she was so far from being the glittering, sophisticated woman of the world. Although she was a year older than he was, time had not destroyed that fragile quality of skin and hair that most women lose so quickly. There was no thickening of her body, no coarsening of her features. "Never mind. Even without medals, you'll be the handsomest man there tonight.
And you the loveliest girl."
As the carriage rolled down Commissioner Street towards the Grand National Hotel, Sean lay back against the yielding support of soft, polished leather. His cigar was drawing evenly with an inch of firm grey ash. The single brandy he had drunk before leaving glowed beneath the starched front of his dress shirt. A faint aura of bay rum clung and hovered around him, and Candy's hand lay lightly upon his leg. All these things induced in him a mood of deep contentment. He laughed easily at Candy's chatter, and let the smoke of his cigar trickle through his lips, tasting it with an almost childlike pleasure. When the carriage stopped before the entrance to the hotel, and rocked gently on its superb springing, he climbed down and stood by the big rear wheel to guard Candy's skirt as she descended. Then, with her fingers on his forearm, he guided her up the front steps and through the glass doors into the lobby of the hotel. The splendour of the place did not equal Candy's own establishment, but it was impressive enough. And so was the reception line that awaited them. While they took their places among those waiting to meet the Commander-in-Chief, Sean spoke quietly to an aide-de-camp. "My lord, may I present Mr. Courtney and Mrs. Rotenbach?" Lord Kitchener had a formidable presence. His hand was cold and hard, and he stood as tall as Sean. The eyes that stared for an instant into Sean's held a disquieting rigidity of purpose. Then he turned to Candy, and his expression softened momentarily as he bowed over her hand.
"Very kind of you to come, madam."
Then they were passed and into the gaudy of uniforms and velvet and silk. The whole was dominated by dress scarlet of the guards and fusiliers, but there was also the gold frog blue of the hussars, the green of the foresters, kilts of half a dozen Highland regiments, so that Sean's black dress suit was conspicuously conservative. Among the glitter of orders and decorations shone the jewellery and white skins of the women. Here assembled were the prize blooms of the huge tree that was the British Empire, a tree grown strong above the rest of the forest. 2 centuries of victory and war had nurtured it. 200 million persons were its roots that sucked in the treasures of half the world and sent them up along the shipping lanes to that grey city astride the Thames that was its heart. And there, this rich sap was digested and transmuted into men. These were the men whose lazy speech and careful nonchalance reflected the smugness and arrogance which made them hated and feared by even the trunk of the great tree that gave them flower. while the lesser trees crowded closer and sent their own roots out to divert a little of its sustenance to themselves, the first disease had already eaten into the wood beneath the bark of the giant. America, India, Afghanistan, and South Africa had started the dry rot that one day would bring it crashing down with a force that would shatter its bulk into so many pieces as to prove it not teak but soft pine. Watching them now, Shaun felt himself apart from them, closer in spirit and purpose to those shaggy men whose Mausers still shouted desperate defiance at them from the vast brown felt. These thoughts threatened to spoil his mood, and he thrust them down, exchanged his empty glass for another filled with bubbling yellow wine, and attempted to join the banter of the young officers who surrounded Candy. He succeeded only in conceiving a burning desire to punch one of them between his downy moustaches. He was savouring the idea with increasing relish when a touch on his arm turned him. "Hello, Courtney. Seem to find you everywhere. There is either a fight or a free drink." Startled, Shaun turned to look into the austere face and incongruously twinkling eyes of Major General John Aitchison. "Hello, General. I notice you frequent the same areas," Shaun grinned at him. "Bloody awful champagne. Old K must be economizing." Then he ran his eyes over Shaun's immaculate evening dress. "A bit difficult to tell whether you've received the awards for which I recommended you." Shaun shook his head. "Still a sergeant. I didn't want to embarrass the general staff by appearing in my chevrons." "Ah!" Aitchison's eyes narrowed slightly. "Must be some hold-up. I'll look into it. I assure you I'm quite happy this way." Aitchison nodded and changed the subject. "You haven't met my wife." This was patronage on the grand scale. Shaun was not to know that Aitchison considered him his personal good luck charm. His own rapid promotion dated from their first meeting. Shaun blinked in surprise before answering, "I haven't yet had the honour, no." "Come along, then." Shaun excused himself from Candy, who dismissed him with a tap of her fan, and Aitchison steered him through the press towards a group at the end of the room. A dozen paces from it, Shaun stopped abruptly. "Something wrong?" Aitchison asked.
No, nothing."
Shaun started forward again, but now his eyes were fastened with fascination on one of the men who was a part of the group towards which they were headed. A slim figure in the dark blue dress uniform of the Natal Mounted Rifles, sandy brown hair brushed straight back from his high forehead, nose too big for the mouth, and the chin beneath it, slightly round-shouldered, but with the highest reward for bravery showing purple and bronze beside the striped ribbon of the Distinguished Service Order on his chest, while on his shoulders the silver crowns and lace proclaimed him a colonel. Slowly, with a new awakening of his guilt, Shaun let his eyes move down to the man's legs. With incomprehension he saw them perfectly matched, booted in polished black leather. Only when the man moved slightly, shifting his weight, Shaun saw the leadenness in one of them and understood.
"My dear, I would like to present Mr. Courtney. I think you have heard me speak of him. He was with me at Colenso and on the train a few weeks ago."
"Indeed, Mr. Courtney, this is a great pleasure."
She was plump and friendly, but Shaun was hardly able to murmur the correct response, so conscious was he of the other eyes upon his face.
"And this is Major Peterson of my staff," Shaun nodded. "Colonel Courtney, you probably know, seeing that you bear the same name, and not to mention the fact that he is your commanding officer."
For the first time in 19 years, Shaun looked into the face of the man he had crippled.
"Hello, Gary," he said, and held out his hand.
He stood with it out and waited. Gary Courtney's lips moved. He hunched his shoulders, and his head swung slightly from side to side.
"Take it, Gary. Please, please, take my hand."
Shaun tried silently to urge him. Realizing the forbidding set of his own countenance, Shaun forced his lips into a smile. It was an uncertain thing, that smile. It trembled a little at the corners of his mouth. In response, Gary's own lips relaxed, and for a moment Shaun saw the terrible longing in his brother's eyes.
"It's been a long time, Gary. Much too long.
Sean prodded forward with his open right hand.
Take it, oh God, please make him take it.
Then Gary straightened. As he did so, the toe of his right boot scraped softly, awkwardly, on the marble floor. The naked longing in his eyes was glazed over. The corners of his mouth lifted upwards in something close to a sneer. Sergeant! His voice was too loud, too high. Sergeant, you are incorrectly dressed! Then he turned, pivoting on the dead leg, and limped slowly away through the throng. Sean stood with his hand still out, and the smile frozen on his mouth.
You shouldn't have done that to us. We both wanted. I know you wanted it as much as I.
Sean let his hand fall empty to his side and balled it into a fist.
You know him? Aitchison asked softly. My brother.
I see, Aitchison murmured. He saw many things, and one of them was the reason why Sean Courtney was still a sergeant. Major Peterson coughed and lit a cigar. Mrs. Aitchison touched the general's arm. My dear, Daphne Langford arrived yesterday. There she is with John. We must have them to dinner. Of course, my dear. I will ask them this evening. They turned their attention on each other, giving Sean the respite he needed to recover from his snubbing.
Your glass is empty, and so is mine, Courtney. I suggest we go on to something more substantial than Kay's cooking champagne.
Brandy. Fiery Cape brandy. Very different from the soapy liquor they made in France. A dangerous spirit to take in his present mood, and only one mood was possible for Sean after what Gary had done to him. Cold, murderous rage. His face was impassive. Politely, he responded to Mrs. Aitchison's charm. Once he smiled at Candy across the room, but always he sent brandy after brandy down to feed the rage that seethed in his belly. His eyes followed the figure in dark blue as it limped from group to group. The aide-de-camp, who arranged the dinner seating, could never have known that Sean was a mere sergeant. As Mrs. Rotenbach's guest, he believed him to be an influential civilian, and placed him high at the long table between Candy and Mrs. Aitchison, with Major Peterson below him and a brigadier and two colonels opposite. One of the colonels was Garrick Courtney. Beneath the almost uninterrupted stare which Sean fastened on him, Gary became nervously garrulous. Never once meeting Sean's eyes, he aimed his remarks higher up the table, and that bronze cross suspended on the ribbon of shot purple silk that bumped against his chest each time he leaned forward gave a weight to his opinions that was evident in the attention they received from the officers of general rank. The food was excellent. Rock lobster that had run the gauntlet of Boer blockade from the Cape, plump young pheasant, venison, four assorted sauces, even the quality of the champagne had improved. But Sean ate little. Instead, he gave permanent employment to the wine steward who hovered behind his chair.
"And so," said Garrick, as he selected a cigar from the cedarwood box that was offered him, "I cannot see hostilities continuing another 3 months at the outside."
"I agree with you, sir," Major Peterson nodded. "We'll be back in London for the season."
"Poppycock,"
Sean made his first contribution to the discussion. It was a word he had learned only recently, but he liked it. Besides, there were ladies present. Peterson's face chameleoned to a creditable match with the scarlet of his dress coat. Aitchison started to smile and then changed his mind. Candy wriggled in anticipation, for she had reached the edge of boredom, and chilly stillness fell over that area of the table.
"I beg your pardon?"
Gary looked at him for the first time.
"Poppycock!"
Sean repeated, and the wine steward stepped forward to cascade champagne into the crystal bowl of his glass, an operation which he had repeated at least a dozen times during the course of the evening. By this time, it commanded the attention of the entire company.
"You don't agree with me?" Gary challenged.
"No."
"Why not?"
"Because there are still 18,000 Boers in the field, because they are still an organized army, because not once have they had a decisive defeat inflicted on them, but mainly because of the character of these 18,000 that are left."
"You don't..."
Gary's voice was petulant, but Aitchison interrupted smoothly. "Excuse me, Colonel Courtney." Then he turned to Sean. "I believe you know these people," he hesitated, and then went on.
You are even related through marriage.
My brother-in-law leads the Weinberg Commando, Sean affirmed.
The old boy knew more of his past than he suspected. Must have made a few inquiries.
Sean was flattered, and the harshness gone from his voice.
What, in your opinion, will be their course of action from now on?
Aitchison pursued the subject, and Sean tasted his champagne while he considered his reply.
They'll scatter. Break up into their traditional fighting units, the commando.
Aitchison nodded. From his position on the general staff, he knew this had already happened.
In so doing, they will avoid the necessity of dragging a supply column with them. Once the rainy season begins, these small units will find grazing less of a problem for their horses.
Yes. Sean saw they were all listening now. He thought quickly, cursing the wine that had dulled his brain.
They will avoid battle. Run from it, and swing round to jab at the flanks, then run again.
Supplies? Asked the brigadier.
The veldt is their storeroom. Each farm upon it is a haven.
Ammunition? Weapons?
Clothing? Persisted the brigadier.
Every British soldier they capture or kill will provide a brand new Lee Metford rifle and 100 rounds of ammunition.
But how long can they live like that? Gary spoke indulgently, as though to a child.
How far can they run?
He glanced around at the others, seeking their support. But everyone was watching Sean.
How wide is the veldt? That is how far they can run. Sean turned on him, stung by the tone of his voice. My God, you know them. Hardship is a way of life with them. Pride, the watchword that will carry them on.
You paint a pretty picture, Gary smiled easily. It is unusual to find such appreciation of grand strategy among the rank and file.
Then he looked higher up the table once more, with an emphasis that excluded Sean from the conversation.
As I was saying, General Aitchison, I believe... One moment, please, Colonel.
Aitchison in turn excluded him, and put his question to Sean.
If you had the running of it, what plan of action would you adopt?
Across the table, Garrick Courtney coughed in a manner intended to inform the company that his brother was about to make a fool of himself.
It was not lost on Sean.
The problem revolves around one single fact, the mobility of the enemy, he stated grimly.
Your perception does you great credit, murmured Gary.
Our first problem is to contain him and then to wear him down, Sean went on, trying to ignore the taunts of his brother.
Contain him? The brigadier fired the question.
Hold him into a limited area, Sean explained.
How?
Say, by a series of set fortifications. Sean suggested.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you propose to divide the whole of the Highveld into paddocks and farm the enemy as one would dairy cattle.
Gary was still smiling.
The new blockhouse lines along the line of rail are proving effective. It should be possible to extend them across the open veldt. Every time the enemy had to pass through them, he would be subjected to a mauling by the garrisons, and his position would immediately be pinpointed.
The cost would be enormous, Aitchison pointed out.
Not as great as supporting an army of 250,000 men in the field for another 5 years.
Sean brushed his objection aside. He was well set on his run of ideas.
Then, within the defined areas, small, well-mounted bodies of men, unimpeded by supply wagons and artillery, could be used to raid the commandos, hitting them in an unrelenting series of raids and ambushes, driving them onto the blockhouse lines, wearing down their horses, giving them no chance to rest, employing exactly their tactics of skirmishing. Against the commandos, use counter-commandos.
Aitchison nodded thoughtfully.
Go on, he said.
Then clear out the farms, Sean went on recklessly. Bring in the women and the old men whose crops keep the commandos fed. Force them to operate in a vacuum.
In the years ahead, Sean was to regret the impulse that made him say that.
Perhaps Kitchener would have scorched the land without Sean's suggestion.
Perhaps he had no hand in the formation of the concentration camps that bred bitterness Sean would spend the rest of his life trying to sweeten. But he could never be certain. He was drunk and angry. But later this knowledge would not comfort him. Now suddenly he felt empty, as though in a premonition of the monstrous seed he had sown, and he sank into brooding silence while the others passed his ideas back and forth, building on them, already beginning to plan. When the dinner party broke up and they drifted through to drink coffee, Sean made one more attempt to tear down the barrier between his brother and himself. He went to him with his pride in his hands and offered it.
"I was in Ladyburg last month. All's well there. Ada writes to say, I receive a weekly letter not only from my wife, but from my stepmother and my son. I am fully aware of the latest news from home. Thank you."
Gary stared over Sean's shoulder as he replied.
"Gary."
"Excuse me." Gary nodded briefly and limped away to speak to a brother officer. He kept his back towards Sean.
"Let's go home, Candy."
"But Sean..."
"Come on."
Sean slept very little that night.